Downtown Productions in cooperation with Zone Radio presents Downtown the Podcast. From the historic Zone Radio studios, here's your host, Rich Kimball.
Hey there, welcome back, or for the first time, to Downtown the Podcast. Rich Kimball here with you, our little get-together brought to you every week by Renewal by Anderson, your trusted window and door replacement expert of Greater Maine. Offering free in-home consultation right now. Buy two windows or doors at regular price, and you get the third one at 50% off. In Maine, call 207-275-6622 or visit renewalbyanderson.com. The better way to a better window. Episode number 299 of the podcast this week. Two fine conversations ahead a little bit later on. Music journalist Joel Selvin talks about his terrific new book, Drums and Demons, The Tragic Journey of Jim Gordon. And it's a fascinating story about one of the great drummers in rock history and a mental illness that would eventually lead to him killing his mother quite violently, and he would spend the rest of his life in prison. We'll talk with Joel about that in a bit. But up first, talented journalist and author Mark Larson joins us to talk about his brand new book called Working in the 21st Century. First of all, how would you describe the relationship between Studs Terkel's book and your version, Working in the 21st Century?
I think the relationship is that they run parallel to one another. Some people feel tempted to say it's a sequel to it. Some people say it's an updating. I don't see it that way at all. I see it as a book that was my book as a book that was inspired by Studs Terkel, but looking at the same focus as his, you know, working, but for the 21st century. And so, like I said, my dream would be that at some point a college or a high school would read them side by side in parallel like that. That would be a kick for me.
I was interested to learn that you were actually interviewed by Studs for his radio program.
Not as ready. I was actually interviewed for two of his books. And then I was present for an interview during the radio program with another guest. But he interviewed me for Race and then for Hope Dies Last. He put me in Race, but he didn't put me in Hope Dies Last.
Well, when you began this project and started talking with people, did you go in with any expectations about how our relationship to work has changed in the last half century?
That was a prime focus. I read Studs' book a couple times before I even got started and went into any depth with it, trying to get a sense of what it was like for his workers, knowing very well what it's like for people today, and I myself being one of them. So I was very conscious of the difference. And that's part of what I meant, too, by a parallel. I'm hoping that reading mine will sort of draw that contrast between his time and mine. You know, 50 years ago when he wrote that, between 1970 and 1974, it was also, like us, it was a world on fire. Vietnam, there's civil rights, there's the nascent women's movement, there was Watergate, there was so much going on. And now here we find ourselves in a very tumultuous time again, and it's impacting workers, obviously, and the work that they do.
And how do you think the times that we're in, how does that impact a person's relationship to their job?
There's a lot of different ways. First thing that comes to my mind, actually, is I spoke to a gentleman who runs his own company. It's a small company, tech company. He has seven employees. He told me, he was talking about, you know, my wife and I really need to take a vacation. Ever since I started this, I've never taken a vacation. He said, well, does that set a bad example for your employee? Shouldn't people take vacation? And he said, I've never been in the same room with them ever. They've never shared space. And one of the impacts of that that I wasn't expecting, but when you think about it, it makes good sense. There's no mentoring that can happen the way it normally happens in a workspace.
Right.
And that, I think, is serious. It needs to be dealt with. They could schedule, they do schedule maybe a monthly or weekly Zoom hour with someone who might be a mentor, but that's a scheduled time. I think of when I was working at the Field Museum, for example, I was around people all day. I got to see how my boss handled things. I got to see how scientists at the museum interacted with one another. That all that incidental stuff is absolutely absent. And that gentleman I was just discussing, he's hardly alone in that.
As a teacher, I was really drawn to your educational subjects and especially the powerful conversation, I hope I pronounce your name right, with Gabriela Salgado.
Yes. Oh, yes. Yeah. Yeah, she has cerebral palsy and she uses a wheelchair. And she talks. I found it very moving and candid, but she really wanted to tell the story. She really wanted to be a teacher, and I think she would have become a very good teacher. But when she was going through the internship and the practice teaching, she really was beaten up by the people in charge of the program, but also her supervising teacher, who complained about things like, you know, you can't even reach the board yourself. She was taken aside and said, what would you do if there was a fire drill? How would you even handle that? Are you capable of this? It was pretty blatant, you know, the way they were treating her. And it broke her heart. She even says that in the piece, in the chapter. It just broke her heart.
Well, it broke mine to read it here. Also, I know firsthand what it was like trying to teach through COVID, but what great insight Lawrence Brooks, the school custodian, had, talking about how support staff had to work in the conditions they were under during the pandemic.
Yeah. Students were home during that time, but they had to continue going to work, right? And he complained, too, pretty. You know, this is Lawrence Brooks is not his real name, and this is perhaps why. But he complained about his own union, that they really weren't standing up for them either. One of the things in that chapter, too, that I found moving was his speaking about the absence of children.
Right.
And the impact of that. You know, he talks about how, you know, if he's cleaning up the cafeteria when there are a lot of students in there, then you walk out into the hall and it's suddenly quiet because you're not in that noisy environment. He was talking about that's the way it always is. There's just nobody there.
We're talking with Mark Larson about his book, Working in the 21st Century. A police officer, Kevin Blackburn, had a story that I think is not unique to his profession, and that is that for many professions, the perception of their job has changed.
Yes, a lot of that. He talks about the fact that they're always on the lookout in terms of are there people with cameras? Is somebody going to film something and then misinterpret it and then put it online and then it goes wild? So it makes them very cautious about everything. Now, you can certainly argue you should be cautious. But one of the things that he was complaining about, I don't know if complaining is the word. What he was saying was that it gets misinterpreted a lot. And also we had our conversation not long after George Floyd was murdered by a police officer. And he felt where he was, I think it was South Carolina, they're being blamed globally for the faults of a few. So that was his perspective that I found very interesting.
We're going through these discussions in my school about how to work with transgender students and provide them with full educational opportunity. At the same time, there are people in the cisgender world who are upset about some of that. And I laughed out loud at trans advocate Vanessa Sheridan and her comment that more U.S. congressmen have been arrested for bathroom misconduct than transgender people.
Yeah, it's all the more funny because she actually said it to a group of D.C. administrators. She directly said it. She didn't know if it was going to go over or not, but she got a good laugh out of it. So.
Andy Borowitz was great, and he talked about the challenge of commenting on the news and being a humorist, a satirist in these times. And he said essentially that the political landscape is like a sitcom, almost with stock characters.
Is that an interesting way of looking at it? I think that came about because that response came about because I was asking him, you know, you have to watch the news. You're constantly tuned into it, and doesn't that ever get you down? And he says, I like to watch it as a narrative, as an ongoing narrative. And like you said, there are the various stock characters, and that's what he plays with, and he plays on our understanding of those characters. It's also interesting to note that he was a showrunner for sitcom.
Right.
He and his wife started, or created Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, for example. So he kind of brings that sensibility to it.
So, Mark, is there a theme, did you find in your conversations with the way technology has impacted work?
A theme. It's the way I would put it is... Technology has dramatically impacted work in that it is so omnipresent and your reach goes so far. We were just talking about that in terms of the police officer who worries about somebody filming something and then it going viral. That capacity was never there before. One of the things I wish I'd done more with was AI, but as I was finishing this book up, I was only beginning to be aware of it myself and its impact. And I talked to several teachers about it, too, as I was nearing the end. And they told me, we haven't even begun to think about this, how it affects teaching. So if I was going to do a volume two, I would certainly be looking at AI in that way.
Mm. What have you found are the long-range implications for COVID on the workplace?
One of the strong impacts that I think is going to have a lasting impact is people have figured out that they can work from home very efficiently. And that, I don't think, is going to go away. I spoke to a lawyer who, you know, had for his whole career, he had an office and he'd go to the office and so forth. He said, I think these offices downtown are going to be going away because we've gotten used to that. And I keep reading about, too, these office buildings that are emptying out. Then you have the ancillary impact of, well, what about the person who runs the little, you know, store in the building, right? The convenience store in the building. What about the custodians? What about all the people whose income depends on people going to work? I think that's going to be a lasting impact of COVID. I also think of a nurse who also is a nurse who trains young nurses. And she was really, we were talking right early in COVID, and she was really worried about the impact of the impact on the younger nurses who should be learning in the hospital itself, but were on Zoom, were learning on Zoom for several years. And so what's that like? If you've never, you know, put a needle in somebody's arm, if you've never held somebody's hand during that early part of your training. And she wondered aloud about what's the long-term impact going to be on those students, too.
You interviewed over 100 people for the book, and I got the sense that certainly they wanted to talk or they wouldn't have participated, but that people were pleased to have the opportunity to express some of their feelings about work and how it's changing.
Yes, and in fact, you know, I don't know if you're expressing surprise about that, but I do. I was surprised. Very few people even turned me down on this, and way more than I expected wanted me to use their real name, too. Doug's had a habit of not using real names. He gave me a pseudonym in Race, too, and I thought that might be the way I'd be going, but after repeatedly showing them chapters and talking about it, they still wanted their name used, and I thought that was really interesting. They do want to talk. In your profession, you know that. People want to talk about, you know, what's on their mind and express it, especially people who are normally in the limelight and don't have that opportunity to have somebody listen to them for 90 minutes.
And I want to mention that, too, because much as Studs did, you made it a point to give people a platform in this book who don't ordinarily have one.
That's exactly it. I think I used this kind of a guiding principle. Something Studs said was he was looking to hear from those people who don't normally get the spotlight. So you're not going to hear a lot from politicians or, you know, movie stars and that kind of thing. It's the people that you see every day. It's your pharmacist. It's the person bagging your groceries. It's, you know, the bus driver. And that's what I wanted to focus on, too. Studs' rationale was they get plenty of chance.
Mm. People clearly still take pride in doing their work and in a job well done. But did you find during the course of these conversations that as many people still see work as their identity as they might have in earlier generations?
That's interesting that you keyed in on that. There is a strong sense of a person's identity tied to their work. I found that over and over and over again. This is who I am. I want to be recognized for that. I want you to know, you know, like a teacher. Teachers, for example, this is the work they want to do. And I think they're constantly having to battle the notion that if they were only smarter, if they only worked harder, they might be doing something else.
Right.
You know that notion? You're a teacher. I was a teacher. We heard that a lot. No, this is what I want to do. And I think, and others are like that too. And I definitely wanted to honor that.
Well, the book is an absolutely wonderful, powerful, and I found it to be an inspiring read because it's the voices of the people. We may not know these individuals, but we know so many like them, and we are these people. It's called Working in the 21st Century, an Oral History of American Work in a Time of Social and Economic Transformation. Mark Larson, it is great to talk with you again. Appreciate you making time for us to talk about this tremendous new book.
I appreciate that very much, Rick. It's good to talk to you again.
That's Mark Larson discussing his new book, Working in the 21st Century, here on Downtown. We'll take a quick break for a word from Renewal by Anderson. When we come back, music journalist Joel Selvin on the tragic journey of drummer Jim Gordon. That's next on Downtown.
The better way to a better window, Renewal by Anderson.
Get ready to welcome the freshness of spring into your home with Renewal by Anderson, where your window and door dreams come to life.
This is owner Troy Pearl here to tell you that from your free in-home consultation to your window and door installation, we ensure a seamless home improvement process that will leave you with satisfaction and a warranty. But that's not all. Our exclusive FiberX material, high-performance glass, and custom designs set Renewal by Anderson apart. Experience the durability of FiberX, the clarity of high-performance glass, and the freedom to design a home that reflects your unique style. And here's an offer that blooms just in time for spring. Buy two windows or doors and get the third at an incredible 50% off.
To schedule your free in-home consultation, visit rbagreatermaine.com. That's rbagreatermaine.com.
The better way to a better window, Renewal by Anderson.
On Downtown, one of the classics of rock and roll, Derek and the Dominoes, Layla. featuring Jim Gordon on drums. And later in the coda to the song, playing piano as well. The story of Jim Gordon's life brought to us in a brand new book by music journalist Joel Selvin called Drums and Demons, The Tragic Journey of Jim Gordon. We talked about it with Joel on Downtown. It's ironic, Joel, that most people probably don't know the name Jim Gordon, but music fans likely remember him more for that murder than for all the great music.
Well, the crime buried Jim. It just was so shocking. Brutal, vicious killing of his mother. And it came out of the blue to everyone. I mean, nobody knew about the years and years of torment and the psychiatric treatments and the residential programs. Nobody knew any of that. So it just was this shocking event. And it totally erased his contributions. I mean, you look at the playlist in the back of the book, and you got to go, oh, my God, this guy played on 50 or 100 of the greatest records of his lifetime.
And you talk early in the book about Gene Krupa and what he meant to jazz and swing and how he revolutionized the drum. And I feel like that's what Jim Gordon did for rock and roll.
That's what I was trying to set up with that whole Gene Krupa thing, was that Gene Krupa was such a huge domineering figure on the drums. I mean, he designed the modern drum set, that the people that came out of his generation were unduly influenced by him. And Jim was 11 years old when Elvis Presley broke, and he was a rock and roll drummer from day one. So that's the thing. One of the guys that played on sessions with Jim told me that Jim was the guy who put the roll in the rock and roll, which is a reference to the style had this bubble, this boiling undercurrent that did indeed sort of roll through the records.
And you say in the book, and I love the way you put this, other people played the drums, Jim lived the drums.
Well, Jim was schizophrenic, and all that goes with that made his life extremely difficult. However, I am reasonably convinced that when he played the drums, he could escape all the symptoms of his condition. The rhythmic entrainment, the hypnotic effect of the mighty groove, and the report of striking a drum set with a stick, which you feel in every cell in your body, those two things just push. You just fill up your consciousness and took Jim somewhere where the voices couldn't follow.
And it started early for him with that success coming when he befriended Mike Post in high school and then went on to get some amazing work for a young man, including playing with and touring with the Everly Brothers.
The day after he graduated high school, out on the road with the Everly Brothers, who were, you know, the last rock and rollers of the 50s that were still standing at that point. Yeah, he was a brilliant young musician who everybody that heard Jim in those early years when he was an unknown just immediately flashed on it. And the Jim Keltner, who's probably the studio drummer of choice today, Jim Keltner remembers the first time he heard Jim like a car crash. He was going to the studio. He was part of a folk rock group. They were going to cut a single. And he shows up, and there's already this blue silver Ludwig set that's already set up, and he realizes he's not going to be playing drums. And in comes Jim Gordon. Jim Keltner sits down by the drum set on the floor, and his life pivoted right there. He went out the next day and bought a silver blue Ludwig kit for himself. And what he told me about it was, and this is brilliant, he said, I had to learn to play like Jim in order to not play like Jim.
We're talking with Joel
Selvin. Jim Gordon's effect. I mean, he was this galactic flash, and everybody was just like, oh, my God, where did he come from? How did he learn to do that?
And that work that he did with Hal Blaine and the other guys who became known as the Wrecking Crew, it covered such a broad spectrum of music, but it didn't seem to matter what kind of music it was. Jim had a way to elevate the song and the other musicians.
Every record he played on, he brought something special to, some kind of luminous touch that just was indescribable. some gift of intuition, imagination. It just it's just not like other drummers. And of course, drumming is the act of accompaniment, and the studio musician's job is, as you say, to elevate other people's music, to find a place for yourself in their work. And in Jim's case, he saw the drums as a much more holy musical instrument than most drummers. He was not just keeping time and holding down the backbeat. He would drive the drum part into the fabric of the musical composition. And you're right. You know, he'd play on everything from Merle Haggard records to Gary Puckett records to Frank Zappa to Harry Nilsson to Steely Dan to George Harrison, and find a place for himself in everybody's music.
You have to wonder, too, nearly 40 years later, if things would have been different in these times, because as you write in the book, doctors generally didn't treat the illness. They treated him self-medicating himself.
Yes, a lot of people did not quite understand what was going on with Jim, including the medical professionals he saw. He was too high-functioning. But listen, the schizophrenia is incredibly common. It just blew my mind to learn that it exists in 1 in 100 in the general population. Like multiple sclerosis is 1 in 10,000. So it's just amazingly common. And frankly, they don't have many good solutions. There's a mysterious condition. They don't really know what causes it. They don't understand why it goes into remission. They've seen the effect, and they've dealt with people on a behavioral basis, but the organic roots of the illness, nobody really gets. And Jim was about as bad a case as you could have. He didn't really respond to any treatment, and he was able to afford about the best treatment possible. He saw dozens of psychiatrists. He was in residential treatment programs 15 times in 5 years. That's like checking into a mental hospital every couple of months. But there was nothing that would stem the flow, the tidal flow of these voices in his head that were torturing and tormenting him. They're called command hallucinations, and they're among the most extreme symptoms of all mental health. The voices in his head would insist he do something, and if he didn't do it, they would give him a headache, the likes of which you and I don't know. He'd be squirming on the floor, wetting his pants. Psychiatrists know about this symptom. They call it the electric hat band. Jim called it white hot cruelty pain.
It is a remarkable story. Drums and Demons, The Tragic Journey of Jim Gordon. Joel Selvin, tremendous job as always. Loved the book, and it's great to have a chance to talk with you once again.
I'm so glad to be here and talk about Jim with you. He touched my heart deeply, and he got so little compassion and understanding in his lifetime. It'd be good to get him a little here now that he's gone.
No question. Thank you so much, Joel. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
What a terrific book, Drums and Demons, The Tragic Journey of Jim Gordon. That's author Joel Selvin with us here on Downtown. Our thanks to Joel, and thanks to Mark Larson as well. We remind you that Downtown is produced by Carrie Haskell and brought to you every week by Renewal by Anderson, a better way to a better window. We'll see you next time right here on Downtown.